Good evening. It's a very great pleasure to have Ron Dorr here to launch his great book on stock market capitalism, welfare capitalism, Japan and Germany versus the Anglo-Saxons. As probably most of you know, Ron has been really the originator of the debate about types of capitalism, what type of capitalism, going back very, very many years. In 1973, he published his great book on the success of Japan, British factory, Japanese factory. And then, of course, he went on to be interested in the success of Germany. And some years ago, he conceived this project of writing this book about which way capitalism. Of course, at the same time, the world was moving on, which made his task a little more difficult, as I'm sure he's going to tell us. Japan lost some of its luster, and Germany, having gone up, went down, and now coming up again. So I think that it's not surprising that he's had to give a great deal of thought to what the significance of the recent events is, as well as the earlier events, in thinking about which way global capitalism can go now. I'll just read you the... I'm allowed to do some salesman work, aren't I?
Absolutely.
I'll read you the names of the parts of this book. Part one, the original Japanese model. Part two, change and controversy in Japan. Part three, German parallels. And part four, conclusion, nice guys finish last, ? So that perhaps is a foretaste of what he's going to talk about. His title for the lecture is Will Global Capitalism Be of the Anglo-Saxon Variety? Ron.
Thank you, Richard, for that warm introduction. I think one of the things that clearly emerges from that is that I've been around a long time. And perhaps it is the privilege of an old man to start off with reminiscence. And the thing that comes most relevantly to mind is a panel on which I sat some 25 years ago under the auspices of the predecessor of our Economic and Social Research Council, which then called itself the Social Science Research Council, until it had to change its name when its chairman, in order to head off savage budget cuts, accepted Keith Joseph's contention that economics was not social and it wasn't even a science. And so it became the Economics and Social Research Council. The panel was on the social responsibility of industry. I don't remember very clearly our discussions or even our report. One thing that remains vividly in mind is a rather eminent Oxford philosopher who, towards the end, when we were discussing the final report, said, "Tell me, what is this invisible hand that you say is losing its grip?" It was, the report was very much a mixed economy report. And I was interested, Richard, in reading your introduction to your splendid collection of essays, where you say until the age of 31, you believed in the mixed economy and didn't much like the profit motive, until you then started learning economics and realized its importance. Almost tempted to say until you grew up and learned to love the profit motive. But it was a mixed economy report, not in the sense that it dealt with the balance between public and private enterprise, but in arguing that people worked and should work for a mixture of motives, and that corporations ought to have a mixture of objectives, not just profit maximization, and ought to acknowledge a mixture of obligations. Obligations to what later became known as stakeholders, not just to shareholders. One other memory, if I may be forgiven one, and that is of the austere Richard Titmuss in the academic board meeting upstairs, arguing that university professors should not be paid supplementary fees for marking examinations. Richard said you were paid a decent salary to do a job, and you had a duty to do all that the job required. Well, he lost the argument. Once again, the mixed economy, the mixed motive economy. The pragmatic consensus was people do indeed work for a mixture of motives, and for academics, as for others in the public service, duty, public spirit, a sense of responsibility to students and to the discipline, together with the enthusiasm generated by intellectual curiosity and the competition for reputation, ought to be the overwhelmingly dominant motivators. But the pragmatic consensus held, a bit of extra cash can also help carry you through the more boring parts of the job. Now, the shift in that pragmatic consensus over the last 20 years has been remarkable. From the notion of a bit of extra cash as a useful marginal incentive to the belief that cash and the fear of being deprived of cash are the only reliable means of stopping people from shirking, to use the economist jargon phrase, from becoming lazy time servers. Both the main British parties now share the belief that only competition for private profits can bring us efficient train services or cheap electricity or safe nuclear fuel. Performance-related pay has been spread throughout the public service. The academic marketplace gets more like a prize bull market every day. And in industry, there is ever heavier reliance on stock options rather than a fixed salary as a form of executive remuneration. But what I want primarily to talk about is economic institutions and the way they embody economic motives. The popularity of stock options for directors and senior executives has a double significance. Not only does it reflect the dominant view about why people work rather than shirk, it also serves to align the private interest of the manager agent with that of his shareholder principal, and hence contributes to reinforcing the shift to shareholder sovereignty in business philosophies, which has been going on over the last 20 years. The talk about the social responsibility of corporations, so-called stakeholder theories, which were popular in business schools 20 years ago, have all but disappeared in the business schools of today. I remember George Akerlof, 20 years or so ago, trying to extirpate it in a lecture in this very theatre. He argued if doing good was what you wanted, then you could get more high-quality good done by single-minded maximization of profits and donating your superior profits, like Rockefeller, to charity, rather than by diluting your profit drive in order to be nice to your employees or your suppliers. Now, today there's no need for such exhortations, for that has become the dominant consensus. Maximizing shareholder value is indeed what management is supposed to be about. Treating your employees or your customers or your suppliers decently is fine, provided it can be shown, and only if it can be shown, to count on the bottom line, to increase earnings or raise the share price. So the first point I want to make is that the Anglo-Saxon capitalism, whose global spread, and more particularly spread to Japan and Germany, is the subject of this lecture, is an evolving set of institutions, not a static constant, and has evolved into something rather different today from what it was 20 years ago. I know, by the way, apropos of the Anglo-Saxon and Anglo-Saxon capitalism, that a lot of people in Britain and the United States who have neither Angles nor Saxons among their ancestors object strongly to the term. I can only plead that it was Michel Albert who scooped us when we started wanting to write this book about Japan and Germany. Michel Albert in his Capitalism Against Capitalism, who used the term Anglo-Saxon capitalism, has made it something of a, of a term of art in the variety of capitalism today. And also, one might justify the racial cultural epithet by the fact that Australia, New Zealand and Canada do in fact share with Britain and the United States many characteristics which differentiate them from other countries. Anyway, as for the source of these changes over the last 20 years in Anglo-Saxon capitalism, it's been fashionable over the last 5 years to attribute almost everything that happens to the processes of globalization. Now, it's true that globalization has something to do with it. The growth of international trade and investment made it administratively pretty impossible to maintain foreign exchange controls. This had reverberating consequences, among them, for instance, the growing dominance of American financial institutions in world financial markets, and not only down the road in the city. It was mostly Frenchmen who were advising both Elf Aquitaine and Total in their takeover battle in France last year. And it was young Germans advising Mannesmann. But they were doing so as employees of American investment banks, and they were working to American methods and criteria, applying wisdom that they gained in American business schools. Likewise, American cultural hegemony, clearest of all perhaps in the economics profession, has helped to diffuse institutional practices worldwide, whether it be deregulation of stockbroking fees or the introduction of working families tax credit. But those aspects of globalization, direct consequences of the growth in cross-border transactions, are far from being the whole of the story. It was not because Englishmen were going abroad for their mortgages in droves that control over building society interest rates was abolished in the 1980s. So that now, as we saw recently, the only way of cooling off the housing market is to raise interest rates in general at the expense of manufacturing industry. Why did that happen? Because of the ideological conviction of the Thatcher government that consumers were sovereign, that competition would produce the cheapest mortgages for consumers, and that that was the only thing that mattered. And so, with many of the other changes which have contributed to making the stock market ever more central to the economy and shareholder value the central concern of management. They have precious little to do with the constraints of globalization and a lot to do with the shifts in ideology and the expression of ideology in economic policies. The growth of private savings with the cutback in basic pensions and the withering away of SERPs had to do with the Thatcher government's belief that the welfare state was a vicious breeder of dependency. The shift of private savings from fixed interest vehicles to equity, encouraged by tax concessions in the personal equity plans, now renamed the individual savings accounts, that had to do with that government's faith in the stock market as the most efficient means of allocating capital and improving national competitiveness. Likewise, globalization had little to do with the shift of corporate pensions from defined benefit to what euphemistically called defined contribution forms. Defined contribution means undefined benefit. And the increased investment of pension funds in equities. Though in this, the decline of trade unions also played a part, as it did in the whole process of the establishment of shareholder sovereignty at the expense of other stakeholders. Now, there is an argument that while not perhaps a consequence of globalization, these changes also have a different kind of inevitability about them. They are not just the product of arbitrary and reversible shifts of ideology, but consequences of internal evolutionary change brought by the advance of material and social technology within all industrial societies. Greater institutional complexity, the expansion of individual choice with greater affluence, the erosion of deference, if you like, a continuation of the processes of rationalization that Max Weber talked about, and he described in Schiller's phrase about the demagicking, the disenchantment, the demystification of the world. I might say that in the 19th century, men and women became self-sufficient enough to do without the prop of a divine authority whose support they could invoke in return for the obligations they owed him. In the 20th century, with bigger bank accounts, birth control, more sophisticated education, they learned, by marketizing and securitizing everything, to do without the support of or obligations to nations and other human collectivities, or even to other human individual beings. Larry Summers made this inevitability point, linking globalization and the internal evolution of societies, quite graphically in a recent lecture. He said, and I quote, "In a world without courts, one lends money to one's brother-in-law and relies on one's wife's parents to enforce the agreement. In a world without borders, arm's-length formal contracts of which securitization is only the most canonical example, become ever more critical to innovation and growth, so too do the means reliably of enforcing them." And he actually goes on to say that because the Americans never did trust each other and resort to litigation at the drop of the hat, that gives them an enormous advantage in the world of global finance. So my question is, in the light of these two sets of arguments, the globalization arguments and the inevitable evolution of systems arguments, are we likely to see in Japan and Germany a rerun of these changes which have taken place in Britain and America over the last 20 years, bearing in mind that these two societies are still less marketized than was Britain, if I may be forgiven that horrible jargon, than was Britain even in the corporatist 1970s. Is such change inevitable in spite of the fact that they are societies in which traditionally the stock market has played a much less central role in the economy, where the financial sector has been less dominant and manufacturing more important, societies in which engineers have the edge over accountants more often than the other way around, and the doctrine of shareholder value is still a much weaker element in forming managerial objectives? To start with, I want to concentrate on Japan because it's a society I know best. What do I mean when I say that it is a much less marketized society than Britain? Let's start with labor markets. For executive talent, there just is no labor market in Japan. No headhunters luring managerial supermen with attractive packages of options, pensions, bonuses, except, and in the financial sector, this has become by no means an insignificant exception, except for people who work in the growing number of foreign firms. The boards of the major Japanese corporations are the top managers, mostly appointed after a lifetime of working for the firm. The president, appointed from among them, gets a salary, which is the top rank of an incremental pay structure on which he started 40 years earlier when he was recruited as a raw graduate, just as used to be the case in the British Civil Service before it started recruiting permanent secretaries from the market. His usual stint is 4 years. Then, having had the major say in appointing his successor, he moves on to become the chairman. 4 years later, moves on to become senior advisor. Lower down the occupational scale, and especially in the service sector, there is more movement from firm to firm, and somewhat more immediate influence of market forces, the supply and demand for skills, on pay levels. But even in small firms, there's a strong propensity towards long tenures, with wage adjustments depending primarily on the firm's ability to pay. In larger firms with enterprise unions, even manual workers have an employment system similar to that of managers. That is to say, an unwritten but effective guarantee of employment to retirement, a guarantee to be broken only by generous early retirement packages. They also have a similar internal internal promotion system, which mixes seniority and performance criteria. An internal labour market, economists like to call it, and it is certainly internal, but it is not a market in the sense that we have internal labour markets in this country with competition for specific vacancies and salary negotiations on appointment. Instead, as in the British Army or the British Diplomatic Corps, people are posted from one job to another, and the competition is for promotion from one rank to another, from section chief to vice division chief and so on. One consequence of this is company loyalty, a bit like regimental loyalty. The board members, and typically there are a lot of them, some 15% of all Japan's male employees between the ages of 50 and 54 are members of their firm's boards. Some 15%. And these board members are more likely to see themselves as the elders of an enterprise community rather than as the agents of shareholder principles. One simple indicator of the difference this makes: in the annual so-called spring offensive wage negotiations, a manager who succeeds in talking down the union's demand from 4% to 2% knows that it's likely that his own pay will go up only by 2%, not by 4%. Again, this is very much like civil service pay negotiations in Britain. Now, how can it be that managers have so little sense of being the agents of shareholder principles, in spite of the fact that Japanese law gives shareholders not such very different powers over the firm, from English law? The answer lies, of course, in the cross-shareholding system, which gives most large firms stable shareholders who can provide a safe guarantee against the possibility of a hostile takeover. Many of these shares, 60 to 70% of the shares of large corporations are held either by the banks that do their banking business, or the insurance companies that do their insurance business, or with joint venture partners or whatever, and often they're reciprocal. Hitachi owns several million shares of Nissan, and Nissan owns several million shares of Hitachi. Once again, less market, because these shares are never traded without discussion with the issuing company. Agreed mergers do take place, but the Japanese stock market does not function at all as a market for corporate control, as it does in this country. Agreed mergers, as I say, do take place, but the cultural antipathy towards the idea of buying and selling what are seen as communities is reinforced by the assurance that stable shareholders will rally to the defense if anybody attempts a takeover. So that's one, and the most crucial way in which Japan distinguishes itself as less marketist than, say, Britain: the nature of the firm and the self-perceptions and objectives of managers. I'll skip lightly over the other salient characteristics of Japan as an economy, just picking out three. The pattern of relational trading, that is to say, long-term patterns of inter-firm cooperation which can survive considerable changes in market conditions. A firm and its so-called main bank, for instance, or automobile firms and their main suppliers. Secondly, the second characteristic I'd pick up is the characteristic pattern of relations among market competitors. In any country, there's a balance between cooperation and competition among market competitors. But in Japan, there is a greater tilt than elsewhere towards cooperation, largely through strong industry associations. And the third characteristic I'd emphasize is a strong role for government, partly in a developmental role, that is to say, all the winner picking, selective subsidies, promotion of research clubs, and so on, of industrial policy, but just as importantly, in a sort of umpire role, resolving distributional conflicts of interest, largely in negotiation with the industry associations. MITI and the other the other economic ministries operate in much the same spirit as the army of industry regulators, which has grown up in Britain, but with much of the regulating being done in Japan by informal administrative guidance rather than by statute and regulation. I use the term relational trading as opposed to arm's length contractual trading. Relational banking is another familiar term. One could talk of the employment patterns as relational as opposed to arm's length contractual employment. In the same sense, one can talk of Japan as having relational regulation. The wide applicability of this term relational gives a clue to the, what one might call the systemness of the economy, the way it hangs together. One way in which it hangs together is through what one might call motivational consistency. That is to say, similar behavioral dispositions are called on in a variety of situations. Primarily, the acceptance of certain basic obligations imposed on one as a member of Japanese society, and secondarily, the willingness to take on further obligations, to enter into long-term commitments which seriously limit one's option to shift to another employer, another supplier, another bank. Another mechanism which makes it a cohesive system is, of course, institutional interlock, institutional complementarity, if you like. You couldn't expect to maintain a lifetime employment system, for instance, if you did not have the cross-shareholding system suppressing takeovers. Well, so much for the nature of the system. The system which, until the 90s, received so much praise, so much admiring discussion in America's business schools as the secret of Japan's success. The cooperative synergies of the system, its capacity for long-term investment, was supposed to explain why it had growth rates in the 1980s more than double what the short-termist, ruthlessly competitive Anglo-Saxon economies could manage. Every American weakness, wrote an American banker, was seen to mirror a Japanese strength. The 12-year-old schoolboy in necktie and short pants doing college-level maths. The modestly paid company executive pouring funds into research and development. Clean, crime and pothole-free streets, gleaming bullet trains, world-class factories, high savings rates, and the sober brilliance of MOF bureaucrats, Ministry of Finance bureaucrats. That same banker, addressing a Japanese business lunch recently, said, "Only when we see less well-performing Japanese companies taken over by real owners can we expect to see a thorough purging of excess capacity. Only when the stock market becomes a genuine stock market with shares that represent real ownership of corporate assets changing hands can we find out what Japanese companies are actually worth. And only when owners capture the residual returns of business can we expect them to shoulder the full risks of bankruptcy." Well, that kind of talk has gone down extraordinarily well in Japan. It was a Japanese businessman's lunch that I've just quoted. Gone down extraordinarily well in Japan in the late 1990s. As the new Prime Minister, Mori, said in the Diet the other day in his acceptance speech, "The system and the ways of thinking which for 50 years have supported Japan's astonishing development have now become inappropriate for the world we live in and must be reformed." As to how they're to be reformed, the slogans which have dominated the debate, deregulation, greater disclosure and transparency, better returns on equity, global standards, rethinking lifetime employment, have not been very concrete or explicit, nor was the Prime Minister's speech. But as to why, in the second half of the 90s, there should be such a broad consensus that reform is necessary, it seems to me that there's one overwhelming reason. While the United States, whose deficiencies the Japanese used to be so patronizing about, is now booming ahead, Japan is stagnating. And why is it stagnating? Well, my potted history of the 90s goes like this. The asset bubble of the late 1980s, whose bursting brought a collapse of both real estate and stock market prices, left the banks with a debt overhang of massive proportions. And this, together with a strong negative wealth effect on consumers, brought an initial severe recession. The bank's strategy was to trade through, conceal the fact by cosmetic accounting that rigorous accounting would show them to be technically insolvent, until the economy began to pick up again. Then they could write off their bad debts against profits. This was also the Crédit Lyonnais strategy, collusion in which has recently been getting Monsieur Trichet in trouble. I'm sorry, yeah, right, I'm wandering away. Monsieur Trichet, yes. And thanks to some heavy Keynesian reflation packages, by the middle of the 90s, the economy did indeed begin to pick up. 1996 showed a growth rate of 5.5%, for example. But then, the Ministry of Finance, in a premature burst of fiscal prudence, tried to wind down what was already thought to be an alarming public debt by raising the sales tax and social security charges in 1997. The dampening of consumer spending which resulted coincided with two other factors: the blow to exports and to the banks from the Asian crisis, and the decision to let a couple of major financial institutions fail. The sense of gloom and insecurity brought a major fall in investment and consumer spending. And still today, even though the banking crisis has more or less been solved with public money, Japan's problem is a confidence problem, a demand deficiency problem. Its exporters continue to do exceedingly well, in spite of an exchange rate more overvalued than Britain's. Its second biggest car maker, so badly managed financially that it had to sell a controlling stake to Renault, continues to run Europe's most efficient auto plant in Sunderland. Its industrial research flourishes. The annual number of patents registered in the United States by Japanese firms grew by over 50% during the 1990s. In short, there doesn't seem to be much of a problem on the supply side. It's domestic demand that is the problem. At first, it was a matter of consumers saving too much and spending too little. And now, as spending is further hit by a rise in unemployment and reduced purchasing power, it's hard to see how the underlying productive strength of the economy is ever going to be translated into respectable growth rates. And meanwhile, of course, the American boom goes from strength to strength as its trade deficit grows. Buoyant Americans consume 4 to 5% more than they produce. Anxious Japanese consume 2 to 3% less than they produce, and send their savings across the Pacific to help support the consumer debt that sustains the American boom. It's a funny old world. But that the gloom and loss of self-confidence is the central factor in producing the general consensus that Japan must fundamentally change seems to me beyond doubt. Japanese opinion has reverted after the self-congratulatory mood of the late 1980s to what has in fact been its consistent default stance since 1870. We need to catch up with, and this is a standard five-character cliche phrase, we need to catch up with the advanced countries of Europe and America. Today, though, it is almost exclusively America that people have in mind. Much is known and written in Japan about the dangerous horrors of American society, about its inequalities, about the excesses of American boardroom salaries, and so on. But for all that, in all things to do with competitiveness, America is for the Japanese the model. The exemplars of self-reliant entrepreneurship are to be found in Silicon Valley. The exemplars of bold and effective risk-taking in American venture capitalists. Once, Japanese businessmen used to be sent for Know Thine Enemy purposes to get their MBAs at American business schools. And they came back to their firms as loyal participants in a consciously different system. Nowadays, more of them either go under their own steam or desert their sponsoring firm to come back as consultants teaching how to maximize shareholder value. And it is economists with PhDs from Chicago and MIT who nowadays make the running on government committees. The reformist targets have concentrated on two main things. One is deregulation, more competition, consumer sovereignty, a reduction of the power of industry associations in cahoots with bureaucrats, the end of what was called the convoy system of mutual support in banking, the opening up of sectors like insurance to foreign firms. The second main thrust has been the transformation of Japanese corporations into proper capitalist firms, on the one hand raising profit levels and heightening managers' concern with shareholder value through changes in corporate governance, and on the other, as a means to that end of greater efficiency, much more flexible labor market practices, an end to lifetime employment, and a revolution in pay systems that gives more reward to performance and less to seniority. You'll recall my initial distinction about the forces for change. Globalization on the one hand, in this case, international finance and the force of the American model, and internal evolutionary change on the other. There are two trends of long-term change in Japanese society which lend support to the reformers. The first is a change towards greater heterogeneity and greater individualism. Let me give you a symptomatic quote from a lawyer writing about the cross-shareholding system. He's criticizing a 1980s book which praised the Japanese system as being not plain capitalism but human capitalism. And he says, is human capitalism really so good for humans? In the truly modern labor contract, a worker sells his work. He doesn't sell his soul, his commitment. The employee sovereign firm requires Japanese to spend their whole lives, from birth to retirement, in enforced competition, first to enter a good firm in the first place, then for advancement within it. Spiritual poverty in return for material riches. Now, there are a lot of people who genuinely feel like that in Japan. A second major change. The managers and the chattering classes of the media and the universities in the 1960s were as poor as church mice, saving like mad to get out of employer-owned housing and to buy their own house before they were 50. Today, a much larger proportion of them have sizable financial assets. So the more power to the shareholder slogan naturally has much wider appeal. Well, there's been a great deal of talk about change. And yet, for all the talk, actual system change has been marginal. Some firms have indeed sliced their boards, their large boards, 50-member boards, in two, and brought in one or two outside directors to their top strategy board, but not with any clear shareholder representative role. Whereas 6 years ago, only a handful of company presidents or chairmen made the rounds of fund managers in London and New York, now they go in droves. But the number of Japanese firms with as much as 40% of their capital in foreign hands, much less management 60%, is still tiny. Almost every firm has gone over to what it calls a merit, pay, and promotion system, less geared to seniority. But even in Nissan, under vigorous Renault management, the age of the latest board appointments dropped from the traditional 51 to 52 only to 46 to 47. There were two appointed, one was 46, the other was 47. And the pay spread, which for managers in their 40s used to be about 30% above and 20% below the median, that is the median for lifetime employees of the same age on the same career track, in most firms has widened only by a few percentage points. There is much talk of the cross-shareholding system unwinding, but it does not yet show up in any of the statistics. The law has been changed to allow payment of the directors and senior managers with stock options, but the 200 or so firms which have adopted the scheme have made them more symbolic than a substantial part of directors' emoluments. Deregulation has broken up a number of cosy arrangements which gave producers a comfortable life at the consumer's expense, but except in a very few industries like domestic airlines and gasoline distribution, its impact has been limited. Lifetime employment, as they say, has been rethought, but still it is voluntary early retirement and bankruptcies that are adding to the unemployment rolls, not redundancy dismissals. Labour legislation has enlarged the scope of agency dispatch and other non-standard forms of employment, but the numbers involved are still extremely small. There's much talk, standard OECD talk, about rolling back the welfare state, but the pay-as-you-go pension scheme, which provides pensions by redistributing labour income, rather than relying, like most British occupational pensions, on the distribution of capital income, is still the capital share of GNP, is still, the pay-as-you-go system in Japan is still alive and well, and has recently been revamped in a way that should see it through the worst period of ageing effects. At the same time, a new old people's long-term care insurance scheme has been launched and should have beneficial employment side effects. When Sasebo Shipbuilding the other day went down and applied for restructuring, the list of its diversification startups on which its former employees were to be channeled included a long-term care provider agency under the new scheme. The banks are finally going to get a tax-privileged equity savings scheme like our ISAs, but modelled on the American 401k plans. But nevertheless, 87% of the great pool of 10-year deposit post office savings, which came due last month, went back into post office accounts. Moreover, since the ending of the banking crisis, and with everybody in Japan holding their breath as they watch the apparently unsustainable course of the American economy, the reformers' control over the ideological airspace does lately seem to have weakened. The president of the financial lease firm Oryx, well known as a leading shareholder value man, seemed to do a sharp about turn in a recent symposium when he spoke of coming to have doubts about shareholder capitalism. "I am forever sending out the message that the kind of shareholders we want are those interested in medium and long-term growth. And if it's medium and long-term growth you're interested in, then what you're talking about is what is often spoken about as the Japanese vice, namely concern for other stakeholders." I left myself too little time for the German parallel. Germany deviates from the marketist model in much the same way as Japan. More regulation and restraint of competition, a dense associational life, producing important public goods like the training system, and above all, firms which are run more for the benefit of their employees than of their shareholders. And the debates about competition and deregulation, about shareholder value, about the welfare state, are very similar in Germany and Japan. There are, however, very important differences. First, the cultural gap between Germany and America is far smaller than that between America and Japan. As one consequence of this, German executives are much more likely to be fluent English-speaking participants in an international labor market. Ron Sommer of Deutsche Telekom, for example, used to run an American company. There are far more German executives who are thoroughly at home in an Anglo-Saxon business environment. And Esser of Mannesmann, in spite of his greater attachment, we're told, to German poetry than to cricket, played the takeover battle with Vodafone, as did the chairman of Deutsche Bank on his board, strictly on a "we can provide the best deal for shareholders" basis, without any appeal to cultural traditions, national autonomy, or whatever. Now, I think it would be almost unthinkable that the president of Sony, say, for all his frequent speeches about shareholder value, would ever have done the same. And of course, integration into Europe provides an extra and important dimension to debates about institutional reform in Germany, particularly about financial regulation, competition policy, and corporate governance, with Brussels pushing predominantly in a marketist Anglo-Saxon direction. There's a third crucial difference. The Japanese community firm rests on communitarian traditions. Its structure is governed not by statute, but by conventions, supported only peripherally by case law. In Germany, by contrast, the employee-favoring stakeholder system rests not on convention but on law. Through the twin systems of co-determination, through works councils in the firm, and the legal support for bargain wage contracts between industrial unions and employers' associations, the system balances the legal rights of employees against the legal rights of shareholders. And it does so in a way which acknowledges a starting point of class antagonism and makes consciousness of the zero-sum elements of the employment relation much more salient than in Japan. Hence, whereas in Japan, those who advocate more attention to shareholders only rarely admit that this might mean less attention to employees, in Germany, the battle between reformers and defenders of the employee-favoring firm is clearly joined and fought in class terms, business interests versus the workers and their unions. The survival of the Japanese system depends on the inertia of cultural reproduction and the continuing dominance of a communitarian managerial ethic of benevolent responsibility. In Germany, it depends on the continuing strength of trade unions, and it's hard to forecast which of these two is likely to erode faster. My guess would be that Japan is the one which has the greater chance of resisting incorporation in American-led global capitalism and preserving its first and foremost because of this sense of cultural and racial distinctness. That this is Japanese and that American can become an argument for preserving the this far more potent than similar arguments in Germany. Germany may have had the legal, rational, bureaucratic traditions which enabled it to translate into formal rules older socially rooted obligations of social cohesion. But if they do not continue to be rooted at the informal level in some kind of spirit of community, the rules can much more easily be changed. A second and intricately interlinked factor which makes Japan a more likely resistor to global capitalism is that its corporatism, to use the term loosely, has been more holistic. That's to say, it's depended more on all compromising parties sharing some sense that they have to think for the nation, and less on a simple horse-traded class compromise between opposing interests in a zero-sum game. This is apparent in the annual wage-run debates in Japan, where both sides talk about the needs of the macroeconomy. In Germany, by contrast, in the 70s, the attempt at true concertation of the kind that still works in Netherlands and Austria failed. Inflation control in Germany depended on the way the unions and the employers accepted the discipline of unilateral action and the threat of unilateral action by the Bundesbank. Schröder's present problems with his Alliance for Jobs spring in large measure from the union's unwillingness to move beyond their self-defined mission to maximize the interests of their members rather than to think for the nation. One doesn't have to go back to medieval feudal traditions to explain the difference between the two countries in this propensity for holistic corporatist thinking, even if such deeper roots are not to be ruled out. it's enough to hark back to the 1920s. Japan, too, had militant unions, and those unions had to face not only employers, but also police and the violence of hired thugs. People were killed. But the violence was on nothing like the scale that Germany saw. Nor was the shaping of post-war institutions in Japan as influenced as they were on the Union side in Germany by returned exiles with vivid memories of that violence of the 20s and 30s. The tiny, tiny handful of returned Japanese exiles from China and Russia were vastly outnumbered in the post-war Japanese unions by people who had earlier made their compromises with the military and joined the patriotic labor front in which the pre-war unions had been incorporated. And that history still counts. It means that there's greater scope in Japan for propagating the notion that there is a national and not just a class interest in preserving established institutions and protecting them against the pressures of global markets, global firms, American-dominated global institutions. And there's a final reason why Japan might put up a stiffer resistance, and that is because of its neighbors. There are great similarities between Japan and Korea. On the one hand, in employment institutions, business practices, and views of the state's role in the economy. On the other, in the debates currently underway over the extent to which Americanization should be allowed to go. Very much the same arguments are repeated in Korea as in Japan. And then in China, China's state-owned enterprises, for all their diminishing contribution to GNP, are still the norm setters, and their employee-favoring orientation is not in doubt. Neither is China's nationalistic propensity to resist American corruption of its Confucian socialist soul. Both of these countries are still some way from Japan's industrial maturity, still growing at a very fast rate. Another decade or two, and the weight of East Asia in the whole world economy could seriously eclipse that of the United States and of Europe. And that could have profound consequences. At present, the Japanese are in no mood to think of preserving their institutions because of some valued quality of Asianness. For the vast majority of Japanese, Asianness is backwardness, in sharp contrast to American modernity. But that may not always be so. Particularly if the Cold War, which seems to be shaping up between China and America, really takes hold, as it might well do as soon as the Pentagon perceives China to have a seriously rival potential in missile and anti-missile defense technology. And with that sobering reminder of the interrelationships of military power, economic power, and the shaping of economic institutions, I'll shut up and look forward to the discussion.
Well, what a fascinating talk. Who wants to start the questioning? Yes. Here's a mobile.
Comment and a question, please. The comment is that it was from Professor Dorr about 20 years ago, I think, that I received the enormously powerful insight that an economy like Japan appears to be private enterprise and not a socialist. Also glued together by a sense of obligation, and that is why it worked and worked very well and avoided some of the excesses of what would then lead to the greed and price obsession of market economics. And I think that was a very valuable insight, and being preceded by many years of it was all well known years before they got to that point. So I have a personal debt to Encore for that. But my question is this, it seems to me this is the new brand of capitalism we have now, which I agree is certainly not the system, or isn't, or yet another model, or an alternative to the old central planning model for anything. It's the process of innovation and discovery, driven by the network world, has really moved on past all these separate distinctions and separate models. And I wonder whether it has not gone much further, even in Japan and Germany, than he indicates. I mean, Renault arrived in Nissan, everyone is realizing that Japan Inc. is finished, that they have been embraced by and want to embrace the global straitjacket. And that this distinction between Americanism or American-driven global capitalism and everyone else's internet-driven behavior is getting narrower and narrower. And I wonder whether the cultural differences are really there anymore. I mean, New York is stuffed with Japanese restaurants and French brasseries, which have removed large signs of American culture. So we have sort of brasserie capitalism in America. And the American-style capitalism has really become the internet electronic capitalism of the entire planet. There's the core of the planet.
Okay, Ron.
May I respond? I think it depends on one's evaluation of how new is the new economy. I heard Bob Solow on an analysis program the other day saying in a very weighty terms, new economy, yes, I would say about 85% hype. And if you read John Kay on markets in the FT this morning, and on the marginal effect, I mean the marginal profitability of market making, whether you do it through e-commerce or over the telephone, I think one is entitled to be skeptical about these effects. Yesterday, I examined an extraordinarily interesting thesis in Cambridge. A young man who talked to 173 Japanese executives about their relations with main banks and their suppliers and whatever. And it made me reflect on the fact Japan has had telephones and has had the internet. Japan has now, 5.5 million mobile phones connected to the internet, far more than anybody else except Finland. But Japan has had ordinary static telephones for a century. And yet the number of occasions in which, in this man's interviews, they talked of going to see their banker or their supplier, you know, physically going to see their banker or supplier to settle something that could easily be done on the phone, was kind of extraordinary. In other words, they still do value these forms of obligation. And I would have thought that in the long run, when it all settles down, the internet isn't going to be anything like as decisive in changing our form of capitalism, our forms of business relationships, than the telephone was.
Next. Ron, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you're a sociologist, a very distinguished one. The growth of individualism, I mean, it's associated with the growth of criminality. I mean, the most individualistic societies have the highest levels of crime, which are making parts of these societies, at any rate, really pretty unpleasant to live in. I mean, do you think that there is any equilibrating force that will actually reactivate the more paternalistic features of the past? You know, where parents, teachers, employment services, and all these kind of structures actually become more important as ways of trying to embed people, including the kind of obligations of employers that David was talking about, because people find it intolerable to live in extremely individualistic societies. Mm. Do you think, is it, or are we just kind of doomed? Are we in the prisoner's dilemma and we're just being driven in that direction? There's no countervailing force that can come into play.
Mm. Well, I think there is a countervailing force, and it is indeed the fear of the middle classes, the fear that the middle classes increasingly entertain of the lower class, of the underclass, as they often call them. And I think there is there is room, I mean, first of all, for a revival of the social justice argument. You know, the people who are, I mean, this is a long story, but the people who are born with the genes and the family environment that makes them powerful captains of industry, media stars, or whatever and whatever, are very lucky to be born with that package of genes and in that family environment, and they shouldn't try to compound that luck by having very high salaries too. You know, I mean, this seems to me an argument from social justice that will begin to take over as soon as the middle classes get frightened enough. And when they do, I suppose it will be, you know, through coercive measures to start with. I mean, the reintroduction of national in the form of community service and so on. If we ever get a written constitution, maybe it'll be a constitution which not only specifies rights, but also specifies the duties of citizens and so on. You know, one could do an Aldous Huxley or a player piano sort of scenario. But I think that what you put your finger on is a very important ingredient in social change in the future.
About the German system, yeah. I wonder whether you would accept that the injection or partial injection of shareholder value thinking into the German system over the last few years has actually made the German system work better, or do you think it's a black day for Germany that Vodafone won the management battle and that Siemens is hiving off companies in the interests of shareholder value? Yeah. Is that all to be avoided like the plague in your view, or is it arguable that at least a partial injection of shareholder value, if not the full dose, is good for those systems?
You know, it may have added one or two decimal points to the German growth rate. But whether it's good for, I mean, I would, Richard just called me a sociologist, that is an indicator of where my values are rather than where my knowledge is, I guess. I think it is bad for German society, yes, because I think, the sense, and I mean, I foresee actually the possibility in Germany of an evolution in the Japanese direction. Let's say that of the two parts of the co-determination system, you know, the top level board system and the works council system, the works council system could grow to give German firms the sense of community that Japanese firms have. At the moment, you know, with it's extremely ambiguous, and the wage bargaining system and the role of the unions, in fact, acts as a break to creating the sort of community-style firms, to creating in Germany the sort of community-style firms that Japan has. But that could possibly change in future.
As you are aware, Ron, we are constantly being encouraged to believe that the Japanese will very shortly be just like us. I mean, most of the media discussion in the West is about taking stories about some change in Japan and inviting us to think that very shortly that Japan will be just another Western style society. I wonder when you look at that literature, first, did you have any thoughts on it? I mean, why Western reporters should be so keen to make that proposition, but that's a secondary question. My main question is, what indices do you think, do you look at when you are thinking about Japanese society that you think would be real indices of change? I mean, robust indices, you know, national indices. I had the problem with my students who often accept the proposition that Japan is changing, and when asked for evidence, will give me a few cases or something. But I wonder what you, looking at it full time, what things you think of as especially important.
I would look especially at the labor turnover rates in large corporations. You see, there are now two sectors in which employment in Japan is very much market-oriented in the way it is in Britain. One is for derivatives traders and forex traders in the banking world, who move from firm to firm and are paid fabulous salaries and are treated by the personnel departments of the banks and investment companies as something outside their normal system. And the other are the top R&D personnel in these firms who also command a market. Now, if the labor practices which are developing in those two areas actually spread to general management, then one would really have a change. That's the indicator that I would look at first. And then I would look also at overall income distribution figures to see how far the people at the top of organizations who could, if they wished, extend their salaries in the way that they're doing in Britain and the United States. If one sees that happening, then one would say, you know, there's genuine change taking place. But the strength of cultural traditions preserved by a lack of fluency in English is enormous. I talked to I had a magazine discussion with the president of the Japan Confederation of Corporate Executives, who was a great reformer, but a very intelligent one. And he said at one point, and this yes, of course, Japan, but you know, cultures don't change all that quickly. It'll take 50 years for Japan to change. I mean, that was his estimate, and 50 years was taken out of the air. But I think that, you know, there's a great deal in that, and the fact that there are so few Japanese who can converse as comfortably in friendship with English speakers as they can with their own fellow countrymen is an enormously strong insulator of cultures. And it will be effective for quite a long time.
So we ought to measure the number of people.
Hang on. Let's
yeah.
Which, if it were, would represent a willingness to accept change.
Yes.
Although I hear you as being skeptical about the new internet world, the language of that world is
Yes.
But I just wonder whether you feel that the Abuja, before you know the picture that you give, and as a culture and a society, it is a sort of immutable one, which in a way is not changing.
Yeah.
I just got a slightly different impression from the Abuja before, but perhaps that's just a poor one away.
Well, I mean, my feeling about the Obuchi reports is the feeling of my Japanese friends, namely one of puzzlement, that a committee which was chaired by the director of the International Institute of Japanological Studies should have allowed our friend Yamamoto Tadashi, whom you know, to write that kind of report in the government's name. Absolutely baffling, and by no means representative of the general sentiment in Japan, though very representative of an image that that many important and influential Japanese think they have to present to an international audience.
Okay, I think we should stop at that point. We can continue in private. Ron, you said that you've been around for a long time. I would say not long enough. I mean, you've made another major contribution here, and I think that's a great achievement. And I would urge everybody to get to the bookshop as soon as possible, because unfortunately there are only two copies of the book left.
There were only four to start with.
Well, we can't yet assess the full balance of demand and supply, but I would expect the demand to be very substantial, because this is such a very, very important debate and a really detailed and perceptive contribution to it. Thank you very, very much for sharing it with us.